Think about the place where you live. If it's not way out in the country, what do you like about your neighborhood? What do you like about your whole town? And what do you think would improve it? We ask ourselves these questions a lot within communities, considering what kinds of zoning or urban renewal or infrastructure projects might enhance the quality of life where we are. Our guest this hour thinks about this a lot and has changed his own mind greatly over time. Charles Chuck Marone is the creator of the concept, website, and book called Strong Towns. He finds much to criticize in the way we have been approaching community improvements. Chuck is the founder and president of Strong Towns. He's a land use planner and professional engineer. As I mentioned, he's written several books on Strong Towns, writes most of the material at strongtowns.org, and hosts a Strong Towns podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, Chuck Marone.
Hey, it's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how long have you been advocating for Strong Towns by that name? How far back does this effort go?
A couple of friends of mine encouraged me to start a nonprofit back in 2009. They actually filled out the paperwork and got it going. So we've been Strong Towns since then. I wrote a blog like the prior year to that kind of created the thoughts and ideas and used the phrase Strong Towns.
So about 10 years then momentum behind this. And you're in Minnesota, we should point out, which, just in case anybody's wondering where your strong town may be. You write about, you say the way we build cities in North America now would be unrecognizable to an American who lived even a century ago. How different are the places we live?
Sometimes we don't appreciate, because it's all around us, how radical the experiment we're in the middle of. We took at the end of World War II and reshaped an entire continent. Within a blink of an eye, historically, we changed the way not only we get around, I think we all kind of key on the automobile as a shift, but the way we build buildings, the way we position them, the way we interact with each other as a result, everything about how we live is radically, radically different than it has been for thousands of years.
How did it happen so fast? Does the post-war boom figure strongly in how we were able to make such a transition?
I think there were many factors that came together all at once. You know, not only do you have what we've now, like in retrospect, called the post-war boom, other parts of the country, of the world had similar booms at the end of World War II from, cleaning up and rebuilding. Ours was different, and ours was different for a few reasons. I think one, we were the world's reserve currency. We had all the oil. We had all the gold. We had lots of coal. We had lots of energy. We had tons of room. We were the only Western power not decimated by war. So we had all this industry and industrial capacity. Our economic theories at the time were all about depression and explaining the Great Depression and how do we stay out of depression. And so what we did is we combined all this capacity and might with a unified vision, a country unified against common enemies. Now we just turned that unified vision back to, here's how we reshape America. Here's how we create a new version of this country that creates prosperity for everyone, distributes it broadly, creates lots of growth, and through that growth creates lots of opportunity. And we still nostalgize those couple decades after World War II as this golden era when that theory seemed to be working.
You know, we recently replayed an interview from a couple of years ago with the economist Mark Levinson, who wrote the book An Extraordinary Time, where he postulated that that was the exception, not the rule, that we kind of built our mindset around thinking that that kind of growth was going to go on forever.
It absolutely was an exceptional time. And I think for me, as an engineer, as a planner, starting to delve into the math of it is where this struck me the most. When we grow in this passion, when we spread things out over a great distance, it creates a lot of very quick growth. We can think of it financially for cities, for governments, for businesses as a sugar high. The problem is, if we just look at the local government, we take on the responsibility to not only provide police and fire protection to this huge area now, but we're going to, fix all the roads, the sidewalks, the pipes. All this stuff becomes a long-term liability. When you run this out over multiple life cycles, what you find very quickly is that the amount of wealth created in this transaction that you can draw on generation after generation after generation to sustain it all is only a tiny fraction of what you would need to actually meet those promises. And so grows very quickly, yes, and we can create a lot of growth. And you saw that in the post-World War period that you know, this is all brand new. The returns on these investments in the short term were immense. The problem is, over time, the liabilities are even greater and many magnitudes greater. And the more we've done this, the poorer we've actually become.
I'm struck by the example you give of your own hometown, Brainerd, Minnesota, and you show pictures of it from like 1870 when it's basically a bunch of ticky-tacky little shacks and stuff, and you show the phases of its growth through time. So our growth used to be more incremental. I get the sense from what you're saying in the book that we try to leap to like a finished community all at once now.
It's funny because I like to point out in the talks that I give, you know, only God got to the end and said, I'm done, right? Like this work is complete. Humans throughout all of history have always been an iterative work in progress. Everything was something that was evolving. As with all complex systems, our habitat, human cities and the places we built to live in, were things that changed and evolved and adapted incrementally over time to different stresses, to different opportunities. Today, we have the hubris to build things all at once, and we build them to what we consider to be a finished condition, not a condition that will adapt, or at least not adapt easily, not a condition that envisions like a next rendition of something or the next response to stress. We build it all at once, and when you build that way, you create systems that at their core are fragile.
All right, because we're not thinking about a future. It's like, hey, we're here, we've arrived, and this is the way it's going to be through time until we take out the subdivision or whatever. We'll get further into the details of what Chuck Morrone's talking about. His book is called Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. He's also at strongtowns.org, also has a Strong Towns podcast. He's calling us from the radio station where he records the podcast. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Our guest is Charles L. Morrone Jr., who goes by Chuck most of the time. He's the creator of a concept and a website and a number of books on the subject of strong towns. Strongtowns.org is the website. The latest book is called Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. Chuck is a land use planner and professional engineer and has looked at the way we've been doing things and concludes that they are not good enough. We're doing things incorrectly, and we'll hear about why as we get further into the discussion. It's a discussion you are welcome to join at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Chuck, let's talk about complexity in our cities. You seem to take issue with people thinking of cities as complex machines when you seem to think it'd be better if we thought of them as complex habitat. Can you explain the difference?
Yeah, it's the difference between complex and complicated, actually. As an engineer, I'm taught to look at cities as a collection of infrastructure systems, roads and streets and steel and concrete. As a planner, there's a little more nuance in that. We look at zoning classifications and building types and building styles. The reality is that human habitat is a very complex adaptive system, much like a beehive is evolved to meet the needs of a bee, and that involves the needs that are obvious to us, but also more subtle and more nuanced. Our human habitat is evolved over thousands and thousands of years to meet our needs, needs that are urgent and obvious in front of us, like needs to be able to get about and dispose of our sewage and get clean water, but also other needs that are maybe a little less obvious, like needs to share our cultural values and norms with others, our needs to create a certain level of security and protection within our neighborhoods. These are adaptations that we threw away, in a sense, when we got rid of our habitat as humans have known it and started this brand new kind of theoretical experiment in how North Americans should live.
So we come back once again to the example of your hometown, Brainerd, Minnesota, and the pictures from the past of the little buildings that grew into to give way to bigger buildings or were added on to. And this leads to a riff on tiny houses, which really once were the beginnings of many towns.
It's funny because I grew up in a city that still today is pretty poor. I still live here. My family is from – I grew up on the farm homesteaded by my great-great-grandparents. And I remember very distinctly people who were young. I mean, I'm only 46, so it's not like I have this like long bit of history behind me. But people who were young would buy a little house, and you know, because that was all they could afford, would be a tiny, maybe something 600 square feet, maybe something 800 square feet. And over time, as they were able to save a little bit of money, maybe get a promotion at work, you know, they were able to add on. And they would do that as their means allowed. When I graduated as an engineer, as an undergrad, and my wife and I got married and looked to build our first house, I actually was kind of thinking I'd start in the same way, build something small and then add on to it. Every bank I talked to, every you know building official I talked to, every potential contractor I talked to said that's absurd. You build a big house to a finished product, and then you know it has a better secondary resale value. It has a better you know product for you. You can get a mortgage for it. You don't have to kind of cash flow it by yourself. And everything in the system encouraged me to essentially go big or go home. The result of that is we've taken the entry-level product out of the marketplace.
The starter home.
The starter home. We've now said that a starter home is something that's going to be, you know, at least 2,500 square feet. You're going to at least be able to have a 30-year mortgage and qualify for that. And if you really can't do that, you don't get to fully participate in society. You get to be a renter in a marginal place that the rent is going to continue to go up faster than your income. And that's a very different society than the one our ancestors would have been born into. People around the world always had the capacity to start with nothing and through their own efforts work up to have at least something.
We talk a fair amount about the missing middle housing on the West Coast. The Oregon legislature talked about it in dealing with exclusionary zoning in this year's legislative session. But it's clear now from your analysis why the missing middle went missing. We essentially zoned for one kind of house in each neighborhood.
Yes. And I think it's interesting because while I'm sympathetic to this notion of missing middle, a lot of our conversations, and particularly your legislative conversation, still envisions building this in what I think is a dysfunctional approach, building it all at once to a finished state. What we need to do, or so the idea goes, is diversify our products. Right now, you can get into, you know, product A, which is the big single family home, or you can get into product B, which is the large rental or a condo unit. What we need is product C, D, and E, and we should have some kind of top-down all at once to a finished state mechanism for building those as well. And I think what that does is it looks at the symptom, which is there's a whole diversity of housing options that are not there, but doesn't understand the underlying problem, which is that our neighborhoods need to be able to grow, adapt, change over time, and respond to different stresses and different opportunities. We're really not talking about changing that aspect. At least you're not in Oregon right now today. I think if we actually got to that, something more akin to what they have done in Minneapolis, I think is a good start, where they've said, you know, now you can have single family homes if you want, but no neighborhood is going to be limited just to single family homes. You can essentially incrementally evolve and adapt every neighborhood in the city now, at least to a modest level of intensity.
Which, you know, there was this part of the book gave me a real oh yeah moment because, you know, there are times when you drive down streets and you look at all the pretty trees that hang over it. You come down a couple of years later, there are no trees there. They all died because they were all the same age. And if you have a neighborhood where all the houses are the same age, the same style, you have a similar situation, just not a biological one.
Yeah, you go out and you build that new subdivision, whether it's 40 houses or 400 houses. When you build them all within a few years of each other, they look good. Like it's the hot new place to be. There's always this echo effect though. And 30 years later, everybody's roof will fail at the exact same time. Everybody's driveway goes bad at the same time. Everybody's appliances go bad at the same time. You and I understand what the affluent people do in a neighborhood like this when things start to go bad. They look for the next hot new neighborhood to move to. And so at the same time, the neighborhood is systematically and simultaneously experiencing this decline. The affluent people are decamping and leaving people of lesser means behind to try to maintain all this stuff in a community and with a tax base that is insufficient to maintain just the basic infrastructure. post-war development pattern has many of the characteristics of slash and burn style of agriculture. We go in and we use up the land. We make good use of it until it starts to go bad, and then we move on to the next place. This works if you have very slow growth over an extremely long period of time with very minimal populations. We have none of that. We're trying to do this at a rapid growth phase. And like all slash and burn approaches, it ultimately kind of starts to feed back on itself in a very negative way.
Chuck Marone is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a land use planner and professional engineer, created the concept Strong Towns, now listed at strongtowns.org, a Strong Towns podcast. His latest book in a series is called Strong Towns, a bottom-up revolution to rebuild American prosperity. You're talking about rapid growth, and the book encourages us to think in terms of growth as separate from wealth. Can you part that Red Sea for us, Chuck?
Well, sure. I ran my own consulting firm for about a decade before I got cajoled into doing this work, which, you know, has been very rewarding, but is not what I certainly set out to do with my life. When I ran my own firm, it was very easy for us, and anyone who's run any type of you know, enterprise understands, it's very easy to experience growth today if I'm willing to sacrifice my solvency tomorrow. I can do all kinds of things in the present term to create transactions and to, you know, if it's employ people or make sales or do whatever, if I'm willing to take on huge unpayable promises in the future. Humans are actually kind of wired to do this in a sense. This is why people smoke. It's why we find dieting and exercising so difficult, but it's easy to eat that ice cream. You know, we're kind of wired to value the positive, pleasurable feedback today and to deeply discount tomorrow's pain. It's called cognitive discounting. Psychologists have deeply studied this. When we look at it with businesses, or we look at it with governments, or we look at it with any type of financial transaction, when we value growth, and in our economy today, we value growth very highly, we have this tendency to discount what we at Strong Towns talk about as wealth creation. What I think you could also talk about is just your long-term stability or your long-term prosperity. For local governments in particular, when we play the growth game, and you can think of like a Walmart as, you know, the epitome of this, we can go get a Walmart tomorrow. That will create all kinds of transactions, all kinds of cash, all kinds of growth opportunities for us today. But with a building that will only last 12 to 15 years, with tax-based obligations that are literally infinite, or certainly will go on many, many decades beyond that. And you wind up, you know, with a situation where that trade-off over the long term is just devastating. If cities want to become prosperous again, we've got to start talking about stability, prosperity, and wealth creation, as opposed to just merely transactions.
Which sounds like a somewhat slower process. So let's come back to the example again of Brainerd, Minnesota, which in 1870 was a collection of shacks with no water and sewer service. I mean, we want to start a bit above that, don't we?
I think yes. I mean, we look often as that collection of shacks as being like beneath us. Yet when we do the math, and you've clearly read the book, so you know the story of Jimmy's Pizza. Jimmy's Pizza, a little tiny shack of a place in the city that I was in North Carolina, a building that looks like it's beneath us, has a financial productivity. It makes use of the land that it's on to a rate that is 3 to 10 times more than the biggest, most expensive big box stores on the edge of town. Sometimes those humble little shacks, while they might feel beneath us, are actually, first of all, the starting blocks of future success, the building blocks. But second of all, really, really successful themselves. I mean, financially, incredibly productive. So I think that we have to have a new appreciation for and a new understanding of not only the trade-offs between growth and stability, but also the value of some of these places that today, culturally, we kind of look down upon. In many of our cities, our poorer neighborhoods, our neighborhoods that are blighted, our neighborhoods that look like they're in disrepair, our neighborhoods with these little tiny buildings, are actually financially profitable and more productive, paying more taxes per acre and employing more people per acre than the best of the best stuff we're building out on the edge today. It's not even close.
So clearly there's a go big or go home kind of attitude, which you cited already. But so you point out, too, that in the past, private investment came ahead of public. So the little shacks in Brainerd again got built, and then the services finally got there. But it's flipped around now, hasn't it?
This is that feedback loop that creates all complex adaptive systems. And I tried to very tiptoe around the idea of government as a bad thing, because I'm very pro, particularly local government, and the need for us to collectively work together to do important things. But post-World War II, what we recognized was that government could become a catalyst for growth. We could go out and we could build the highways and build the frontage roads and build the interchanges. We could take on the long-term liabilities of all that sewer and water maintenance and all the, you know, required services that would go with new growth. And if we backstop that as governments, we could see tremendous amounts of growth. And the governments that did more of it saw even more growth. The problem is when government leads the way, and government, particularly local government, as a representative and a collection of us working together in a community, you lose the feedback loops that make failure into panic inducement. And it becomes merely like a political uncomfortable. You know, it becomes a situation where, oh, we built that business park and it didn't work fully, so gosh, I feel embarrassed about it. As opposed to when the private leads and you make this gamble on a business park and it doesn't pay off, people actually go broke. There's this huge kind of frenetic panic over how do we make good use of this space? How do we make this work? I'm very pro-government, but I think that our local governments need to look at themselves as stewards of the public balance sheet, not as gamblers at the casino trying to roll the dice for the next big project.
Chuck Marone is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is called Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. He's the founder of strongtowns.org and a whole Strong Towns organization. So we were just talking about the casino then. Bring in your concept of what you call the municipal Ponzi scheme. What's going on there?
I used this term early on, and it stuck, to describe the pyramid mechanism that cities use to fund growth. I worked on many projects like this where you would have a community that didn't have enough money, didn't have enough cash flow to pay to maintain its roads, for example. And so the idea was, instead of trying to go back and figure out why or what was actually wrong, what we needed was more growth. If we could go out and we could get more growth, that more growth would create free cash flow. And that free cash flow could be used to make good on all these prior obligations. The problem, of course, with that new growth was that with that new growth came a future promise to maintain that road. That promise wouldn't come due for 25, 30 years, so it bought you some time. 25, 30 years from now, when that road came due, what was the answer to that one? Well, we needed even more growth. And so you wind up with a situation where the faster we grow, the faster our liabilities grow, and we can't possibly keep up with them. But we're trapped. The only thing we can do is try to induce more growth. Otherwise, we can't take care of the stuff we've already built. It takes on, without the nefarious aspect, it takes on all the trappings of a Ponzi scheme. I think, by the way, it's important to note, even if you look at someone like Bernard Madoff, when Bernie Madoff started his famous Ponzi scheme, it didn't start as an attempt to swindle people. It was like, I didn't make my numbers for this quarter, so I'm going to fudge it a little bit. And then next quarter, you got to fudge it a little bit more to make up for what you fudged the first time. And pretty soon, the fudge gets bigger and bigger and bigger. That is essentially the state of our local governments today, big and small, coastal and inland, north and south. They all have done this kind of systematic fudging of their balance sheets and now need the growth or their systems stop working.
So are you advocating for a slower growth or more modest growth or you know, just don't put sidewalks in until the businesses have actually come there or the homes have been built or what?
We're like very pro-growth. There's nothing about Strong Towns that is anti-growth. The thing that would be kind of a difference for us in terms of how we grow is that we need to grow incrementally with good local feedback loops, as opposed to in a top-down centralized, you know, build all at once to a finished state kind of way. We can think of it, and I can summarize it like this. I want 1,000 small hands growing as opposed to one, you know, big thumb directing everything. When we can create systems that are bottom up like that, we can see robust growth happen over a broad area, but it's more diffused and less centralized.
All right. More from Chuck Marone coming up as we continue to talk about Strong Towns. His latest book is Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. And he suggests that we should stop thinking about the federal government goosing growth and think about it happening at the local level instead. We'll talk about Detroit next and what went wrong there in both left and right-wing versions. That's coming up as we continue to talk about Strong Towns with Chuck Marone here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation by phone and email when we return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're getting an education in land use planning and how we build our cities from Charles L. Marone Jr., Chuck Marone, the founder of Strong Towns. He's a land use planner and professional engineer. His latest book is called Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. He challenges a lot of what we do right now, the way we build these big houses and big subdivisions all at once and don't have a lot of variety in our neighborhoods, and that really helps. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the prime example, of course, of places where growth stopped and then went in reverse, of course, is Detroit, Michigan. So what are the left and right wing versions of what went wrong there, Chuck?
I've traveled all over the country and everyone wants to talk about Detroit. Mm-hmm. They all have their own, you know, theory of what happened. And the left-wing version, something like, you know, it was corporate greed and avarice and the city abandoned by, you know, the corporations that built it. It's a union busting. The right-wing version is the opposite of that. You know, it's about corruption and government out of touch and unions taking down corporations. I find both of these versions to be, you know, wholly incomplete. They're internally consistent, but they're incomplete. When I look at Detroit, it's very clear to me that a big part of what made Detroit fragile was that they were the first pioneer of this development pattern. They were the first ones to run the highways through the middle of their neighborhoods, to rip down houses for parking lots, to build commuter suburbs out on the edge, have people drive in during the day, drive out at the end. When you take a huge city that's very wealthy and prosperous, and you stretch that out over a massive, massive area, you spread it out over this wide, wide space, creating all of this liability in the process, you get the decline of Detroit. You get an insolvency that, like all bankruptcies, happens gradually and then all at once. To me, Detroit is not some crazy anomaly. It's not some, you know, thing that can be blamed on the left or the right. It's the first American city to go down this path. They're a couple of decades ahead of everybody else. We've all copied them. Detroit is in many ways just early.
So this brings us to the whole topic of infrastructure, because it's how so many political figures in particular talk about how we improve our cities by putting in things like the highways and the parking lots that Detroit put in decades ago. What are the politicians getting wrong about wanting to make infrastructure improvements?
I don't think they're getting it wrong as much as their perspective is just different. If you look at, and I write about in the book, Hurricane Katrina was this massive stimulus from the federal government level. It created all kinds of jobs. It created all kinds of GDP growth. There were congressional studies that looked at this. It was a huge boom for the economy. But if you go to the local level and you look at what happened in Katrina, not only the massive population loss, but the huge destruction of localized wealth. New Orleans is a much poorer city, even today, a decade and a half after Katrina, than it was going into it. There's a huge trade-off, and there's a very different perspective between growth as measured at the federal level and wealth creation as measured at the local level. The first is a measurement of transactions, and, you know, we showed it's very easy to maximize transactions if you don't care about the second, which is a measurement of prosperity, a measurement of stability, and a measurement of just overall wealth creation at the local level. We live today in a centralized, federalized system, one where the objectives of growth and the objectives of transactions are paramount. And that's what our cities are set up and designed to focus on next quarter's GDP. We need our cities and our local leaders, and that's everything from the mayor and city council to the professionals at City Hall to those people who are driving and persuading them and influencing public policy, to stop thinking of this in terms of next quarter's GDP growth at the federal level and start thinking about the long-term health and prosperity of the communities that we're building. That's just a different model and a different set of objectives, one that, you know, national politicians and national economists just are not grasping because of where their perspective originates from.
Well, the perspective always comes back to dollars, though. I mean, the GDP grew by this much. You know, we have, you know, this, here's our GDP right now. It's always expressed in the billions or trillions and nationally. But this is what we're all trained to do. What other kinds of measurements should we be using, in your opinion?
Well, but who cares about GDP growth if you're poor? I mean, we can say, like, this year, your wealth, your salary increased by $50,000. And that's awesome. That would be fantastic. But what if at the same time your liabilities increased by $200,000? I mean, that's not a trade-off you can make for very long and still be around. So GDP doesn't really tell us much. It doesn't tell us much about how we're doing, how financially off, you know, we really are, how stable and prosperous our communities are. It's a very coarse measurement that we shouldn't be making national policy around. Yet, you know, every political persuasion, every economic religion that we debate back and forth today uses these as like a central measurement tenet. We should be looking at wealth. We should be looking at our local balance sheet. What are our assets? What are our liabilities? How do those two balance and diverge or converge from each other? We should be tracking these things over time. And the thing that we should reward the mayor from is when our community actually becomes wealthier in a broad, prosperous kind of way. That's actually kind of easy to do, too, when we step back and look at it, because a lot of these investments are taking places that are underserved, underutilized, and we would maybe call today underprivileged, and just making them a little bit better. We can see huge financial gains in wealth and stability by just doing basic maintenance and small projects to improve people's quality of life.
So instead of going for the new highway or the new subdivision, go for fixing up the sidewalks you got?
My gosh. I mean, start there. It's amazing because I think like the greatest investments in terms of financial return, like spend a dollar, get back $5 that cities can make, are things like street trees, crosswalks, better lighting. These are so non-glamorous. They're not the ribbon cutting kind of things. But if we're really worried about making our cities pockets of wealth and prosperity, those are the kind of things we obsess about.
Let's take a call here. Debbie in Grants Pass is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Chuck Marone, the author of Strong Towns. Debbie, go ahead.
Good morning. My question is whether our guest has seen examples of models of excellence in his work. I work with the Malcolm Baldrige Quality Award Program, and there have been three cities across the country that have been recognized in the past few years. Coral Gables, Florida, Colorado Springs, Colorado, and Irving, Texas. They all use a framework of excellence to guide their decision-making, and I'm wondering if there are examples of cities that are doing that you're aware of that you could share, either the models or the cities.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Debbie. Excellent question.
Unfortunately, I'm familiar with all three of those places, and they've all kind of adopted the latest fads. And I would not give any of them an award for doing things well. This is the most frequent question we get, which is point to the city that's doing it well. And I think it's important to grasp that we all of us, every city in North America, is part of this larger system where, in a sense, this has been force-fed to us. So we are all fragile in the same way at the same time. There are pockets of places, though, that have done things slightly differently that I think we can learn from. If you want to learn a tough lesson, go to Detroit. Detroit is on the other side of this experiment. You can find neighborhoods in Detroit in deep distress, but you can also find ones that have, you know, in the absence of other outside controls, kind of embraced this incremental approach again. And there's a lot of kind of new wealth and new prosperity being built incrementally in Detroit's neighborhoods. We see this in cities like Memphis and Buffalo and Shreveport, places where playing the game as it's currently being done is really not working for them. And in ways they have opted out of it and have seen a lot of advancement and success incrementally doing it. So I would hesitate to say what's the place doing it perfectly, because there is none. Strong Towns is not about a destination anyway. It's about an approach. Some of the more poorer cities that have been forced to reconcile where they're at with where they want to be are the ones that we see making the most advancements today.
I want to underscore again your position on infrastructure, because you're talking about this municipal Ponzi scheme where we build these great big things and then realize later on we don't have the money to go ahead and do the maintenance on them. And so we keep building the next big thing, hoping that it'll bring in funding for the next. And now you mentioned in the book, the Congressional Budget Office backed you up on returns from infrastructure investments. What did it say?
It's funny, because the federal returns are actually better on this than the local returns. The local returns are disastrous. But the CBO looked at this, and they looked at just the federal return, and they said, this doesn't make any sense at the federal level. Like, we're doing this spending on infrastructure in the idea that we're creating this great national economy, and that national economy is going to create all kinds of new tax revenues for us that's going to allow us to pay for defense and education and Social Security and Medicare and do all these things. We're losing money on our infrastructure investments at the federal level. What they didn't get into and what they didn't like actually evaluate was the local returns. Your city's returns on those investments are far worse. You get far less of the wealth and the income generated off of it, and have way, way more liabilities than the federal government long term. So yeah, the CBO said this stuff is a disaster. We need to rethink this. At the local level, it's, you know, 10x, 20x the disaster that it is at the federal level.
So, you know, here again, as we talk about urban planning, infrastructure, things like this, we still get into dollars and cents and essentially stuff. I get the sense as we get further into the book that what you're advocating here is really less about stuff and more about people and relationships and things like getting to know your neighbors.
It's funny, because I mean, I'm an engineer and I'm a planner, and these are not questions that I would normally ask myself. But as I got into these kind of deep conversations about why our cities were going broke, why financially they struggle, why they have these huge backlogs of just basic things that they can't do despite decades and decades of investment and people like me giving them advice on how to grow, it became apparent to me that this habitat we were building was not well tuned to who we are. We can certainly measure prosperity in terms of family income. And I think that that's one way to do it. And I certainly recognize that people who have nothing in terms of income have a much, much different set of struggles than people who do. That being said, there's a certain point where happiness is measured differently than what we capture in the finances. I would see all kinds of times where people would come into City Hall and they would say, you know, you're widening out this street so we can get cars moving a little more quickly and hopefully get some growth out here. But I like the tree that you're taking by. Like my kids planted that tree when they were little, or I like this neighborhood school that my kids go to. It means something to me. And that experience, you know, maybe it would be better to have the factory school on the edge where we can put 2,000 kids through at once. But having smaller class sizes, a more intimate setting, is something I'm worth paying a little bit extra for. And maybe we won't grow quite as fast, but we'll have a higher quality of life. I think that these are things that humans of the past struggled with, entertained, and found ways to harmonize, that we in our let's say fear of going back to the Depression have institutionalized as a growth ethic that has not served us very well, particularly as we've gotten through the easy returns on this and now tried to squeeze more and more out of a system that is diminishing in its payback.
Was urban planning better when it wasn't really planning? It just sort of happened?
I think the quick answer to that is yes. I think, though, I'd be cautionary. I think the takeaway often then is, well, you know, you're talking about a libertarianism. You're talking about getting rid of all controls and going back to anarchy. I think what you saw in the pre-Depression development pattern was an evolved human habitat. People understood how to build in a way that was beneficial to them And because of the harmonization of these many competing interests over literally thousands of years, it took selfish human reactions and made them into altruistic kind of community benefiting results. Today, we lack not only that framework, but that understanding. I mean, we're the same selfish people, but we don't have the feedback loops in place to drive for altruistic ends. And so I'm not arguing for no planning today, but I am arguing for a different kind of planning, one that recognizes human habitat for what it is, which is the place humans live and thrive and need to work together.
Well, the book and the concept give our brains a real good stretch. It is called Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. Chuck Marone is a land use planner, professional engineer, and the founder and president of Strong Towns at strongtowns.org. Chuck, thank you so much.
Hey, it's been great. Thank you.